From WXXI News. It's Connections Summer Book Week. I'm Scott Feibusch, in all week for Evan Dawson. And at some point during every book week, we get a chance to get around to simply discussing writing with writers, and especially local writers. And that's one of the things that I look forward to the most during book week. And we have the privilege and the pleasure for this part of our hour of talking with local writer, poet, educator, Sarah Freely. Her new book is called We. It's just out. We'll talk about that and much more in the first part of this hour. We will also hear from Sonia Livingston about what she is reading and writing about a little bit. And we'll hear from poet Alana Bell later on in this hour. But we begin with Sarah Freely. I welcome you to this pre-recorded half hour of Connections. Glad you could be with us.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here in the studio.
It's a nice thing, too. So we are emerging from a year of pandemic. How did you spend it?
Well, at the first couple of weeks of the pandemic, I live by myself. I have my entire life. And the first couple of weeks of the pandemic were frightening, I think, for everybody, not just because there was an epidemic out there that was potentially lethal, but also because things were changing so quickly. Every time I would go to the East Avenue Wegmans, they would have something new, shields and one-way traffic, and the library closed, and my pool closed, and most of my what I did as habit ended. So I had to find new habits. So about in early April of 2020, I started teaching myself French. I'm on day 445. Yeah, I can order. Yeah, I can ask for directions and order food and wine. And I'm learning how to buy a house now in Paris, which will never come about, but I know how to do it. And once I settled into the quote-unquote new normal, that this was not going to change anytime soon, I was fine. I found I was teaching online, but I was able to write a lot, too. Hours and hours during the day, and it was lovely. It was quiet, and there was no kind of outside static. All we had to do was survive, and that's not a bad way to live for a writer. So, you know, little by little, things have started, you know, they started opening up, and I've been fully vaccinated since early March, and my life really hasn't changed a whole lot. My birthday was yesterday, so I went out over the weekend. Thank you very much. I went out over the weekend, probably more over the weekend than I have in the last 17 months. So I'm just getting back to life kind of slowly, and it's okay. So many people that I've talked to, writers and non-writers, have said that what the pandemic did for them was made them realize how they wanted to spend their time. How do you want to live? You know, what can you do without? What do you need? Those are bad questions to ask, you know, from time to time. So, yeah, it was okay. I didn't lose anybody. Several friends were very ill, and that was frightening, but, you know, it was okay. I thrived in a way. I wouldn't want to do it again, but I thrived in a way. And I read a lot, too. Read a lot of books.
There are, I am convinced, as we've been having these discussions all week during Book Week, and I've been asking this question of a lot of writers and readers, I think there are two categories of people. The people who could take advantage of it and were able to focus their minds and sit down and read. And I know for me, at least, for the first few months, the most reading I did was just the mindless scrolling through the phone. I couldn't focus long enough.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To pick up a book or to even get through an issue of a magazine. I've still got piles at home that this is my secret shame from 2020 that I'm going to be atoning for a while to come, is just catching up on back issues of things that may or may not have any relevance in the post-pandemic world. But I'm glad to hear you were able to get through it. So you were doing writing.
Yes.
Some of which is recent enough that it's actually made it into your new volume.
Yes. Much of which made it into the new volume. And this book came about totally by, you know, sort of happenstance. I've been sending out, you know, the traditional way is you send out manuscripts either to a publisher or to a contest, and you wait and wait and wait. Then they tell you, no, you're a finalist, no, you know, go away, or yes, you know, like you won, here's some money. And this one, I think I had entered a chapbook contest, a chapbook being, you know, like sort of a small book, fewer than in the poetry world. A full-length collection is basically 48 pages and up. And so it's 48 pages, fewer than 48 pages is a chapbook. And I think I'd entered a chapbook contest maybe in 2018. And I was a finalist, and the publisher wrote back and said, you know, we really love your work, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, that's very nice. You know, you think, oh, it's just a nice kind of a step up from a form rejection, and they're telling you, you know, make you feel better. So in July of 2020, I got an email from this, from Small Harbor Publishing. They had published a literary magazine up until then, and done an annual chapbook contest, and they were getting into publishing chapbooks and full-length collections. And she asked me, she said, do you have anything? And I said, well, yeah, I do. So I spent a weekend and kind of shuffled things in and out of the chapbook that I've been submitting. And it's basically a hybrid. It's poetry that's, you know, like lineated, and others that would probably be more fall into microprose or prose poetry. And I sent it out, and I heard in September, oh, you know, you're going to be our first book. And I said, that's great. So it came out in January. It was a pleasure to work with them. As I say, they had never done a print book before. And it was just a pleasure working with them, from the cover design to the book design to copy editing. It was just really a great experience, and it's not always a great experience. So yeah, it was
all done remotely, obviously.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You know, like yeah, we. I don't think we even talked on Zoom. I think it was all done, you know, like via email, you know, like exchanging PDFs, and I think they sent me a mock-up of the cover, and that was it. You know, and then I get a box of books, and you know, like late January, and I said, wow, you know, I said, I sort of thought this was what it looked like, but I was really pleasantly surprised at how beautiful it was. You know, the cover, I mean, I love it. It's just such a cute little book.
It is. It's a lovely book. It is not long, writing. Obviously, including the acknowledgments and your bio. It checks in at 29 pages. Where are they based, by the way? I didn't even see that.
They are based in Kansas.
In Kansas.
Yep. Someplace in Kansas. Yep. Anymore, you know, I mean, the publishing industry has really been, you know, the online internet has really changed a lot of things about the publishing industry. And it'll be really interesting, you know, because it used to be all based in New York, and that was it. If you were a publisher and you weren't in New York or an agent, forget it. But now it's, you know, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens post-pandemic when so many people aren't working in an office and probably never will again, or there'll be some kind of hybrid, you know, the 2 days at home, 3 days in the office. And, you know, I mean, it's great for people, I think, and it's not so great for real estate companies that were leasing all this. I guess in Manhattan, it's just, you know, terrible.
Probably not bad, however, for places like Rochester that have the intellectual heft and the quality of living. You'll hear in the next half hour of the show, as we talk to Alana Bell, that she was actually up here where her publisher is and never made contact with them last year because everybody was so isolated. We are talking with Sarah Freely. She's the author of the new book, We, released earlier in this year of 2021. Let's talk about the book a little bit.
Right.
It's a very memory-based book.
Mm-hmm.
It is stories of growing up, some very kind of specific stories of growing up as a woman in a particular time in America. These are individual pieces. How did the theme of this all come together for you?
Well, I started writing. I think one of the last poems that I wrote for my previous book, which is a full length poetry collection, Sad Math, was was a prose poem, micro, entitled We Smoke. And that, it had resisted being a poem for a long time. It just would not lineate in any interesting fashion. So basically, I sat down one day and just set it free from its lines and just wrote through so that it became really a micro piece. But I think at the same time, I changed from a first-person singular I to the first-person plural we. And it was an entirely different feeling. I think William Faulkner called, you know, his famous story, A Rose for Emily, is probably the prime example of the most anthologized example of a story told in first-person plural. And he refers to it as community voice, that it is, you know, like it is a collective of the town talking about this odd woman, Emily, and her life. And We Smoke was, you know, like I loved the feeling of that. I love feeling like that I could hide behind this community voice. Nobody was going to say, oh, that happened to you. And much of it didn't happen to me. It's mostly fictional. I would say 98.9% of this is fictional, that it's other people. It's stories that I've heard, that have been told to me, that I've imagined. And We was a way to, I felt, to get at that material in a way that felt authentic, but it didn't feel like I would pull it down and to the level of personal and just make it nothing but, you know, straight autobiography. And I didn't want that. So I did a few more stories in the first person plural, and I loved it. And I realized I was onto something. So that kind of became what the whole collection coalesced around, that, which is why it's called We. That, of course, there's poems and short fictions in there that are narrated from, I think, second person and or first person singular. But it just felt right. It just felt like I was onto something. That I was speaking as a group, as a collective, rather than as a single author.
Are we meant generally to read this, as I sort of did, as being a collective series of stories about the same group of people?
You can. Absolutely. You can. Yeah, I'm hoping that the we is elastic enough so that it becomes the person who is reading it, it becomes their group, you know, that they can go, oh, yes, I knew this person and this person who was, who experienced something like this.
It seems specific, though, at least in my reading of it, to a specific time, something of a specific, if somewhat undefined, sort of smallish town, America. And I actually, I'm gonna have you read page 12 here, Those Girls, which you talked about microprose. I mean, this is a paragraph in which you tell an entire story, and it's maybe not quite as concise as For Sale, Baby Shoes Never Worn, but it's close.
It's a 50-word story. There is a magazine that publishes 50-word stories, and I said, gee, you know, like I wanted to write a 50-word story, so this is what came out. And I think if you're going to write a 50-word story, that it helps to have a background in poetry where poets understand metaphor and how metaphor will deepen and expand beyond the words. It gives it a density that it might not have without the metaphor. So in here, you know, I started with the metaphor of the muscle car, you know, which is, you know, big during the 70s and the 80s.
You know, it places it in that time.
It does.
And
the
sort
big
of
old
in that
GTO
place.
Yeah. And, you know, like, yeah, the Trans Am. Remember Trans Ams? I remember renting a, when I came back from the Summer Olympics in 84, I was working for the Philadelphia Inquirer at the time. And I was also covering Penn State football. And the Olympics ended and I had to go to, you know, like a preseason something. And I said, can't they send somebody else? They go, no, you're the beat ready. You have to go. So I flew back to Philadelphia after, you know, spending, what, 3 weeks in L.A., dumped my stuff, and rented a car, and I was mad because they made me come back. So I rented the biggest muscle car they had, and I rented a Trans Am and drove up to State College. And I was driving through these little towns, you know, like north of, at the time, north of Harrisburg. It was all two lanes, and it was like driving through there going, yeah, yeah. I mean, this thing was like, it was just had this deep, you know, like roaring engine. It was pretty fun to drive, but they said, never do that again. Do not ever rent. It was, I don't know, $150 a day, and that was in 1984. So
do it first, ask questions later.
Yeah, yeah. So do you want me to, you know, I can
let me, I think we have time to fit this one in.
Okay, yes, you do. Those girls. Olga was fast as a muscle car, one of those girls. There on Friday, gone by Monday to care for a sick aunt in Florida. We knew better. We knew she'd be back in 9 months, flattened, her brass tarnished, smudged with the fingerprints of all who had driven her.
So we know exactly what that story is about.
Oh, yeah.
without ever saying the word there.
Yeah, good. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, all told through. You know, like I have this theory that it might be because I was raised in Michigan, but I have this theory that everything can be told through cars. You know, everything is a metaphor for cars. And you know what? It works. Think about it, you know? Sex, cars, marriage, cars.
Or brass tarnished.
Life, cars. You know, like, yeah, cars work for everything. So, yeah.
There's just some great imagery in here. The next piece, We Dive, which paints this community of girls at three different times in their lives. And as the father of a daughter who is near the final phase of this at almost 18, you know, we serve up the buffet of ourselves.
Yeah.
And that line caught my attention, too.
Yeah, we're up until, you know, like at age 12, which is where it starts. I mean, they can get their hair wet. They don't care what they eat. They go back into the pool again after they eat. And then by the time they're 14, it's, you know, it's become this societal kind of, we're going to be very careful, you know, like you can't eat this and be careful of that. So, yeah. And then by 18, you know, like they become the buffet rather than enjoying the buffet. They're almost commodified in that way. And yeah.
Self-conscious watching her and her friends get ready for the senior ball a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, yeah. I saw that. You know, like when I came over and dropped the book off at your house, that you had the congratulations senior, which is, I would imagine, you know, like being a senior this year was much better than being a senior last year. So
let's talk about timeliness then in the minutes that we have left here, because you've got a piece that is titled Epidemic that obviously is not about the current moment. There really isn't about inoculation at all, but you're using that imagery. When you said you started writing that May of last year, was that a conscious choice at that point, or did that just kind of, the times just kind of caught up to it?
I think it was a conscious choice to write about an epidemic in a way that wasn't a pandemic. I was like one of the people who when the pandemic started, I went back and we were talking about reading a little while ago and focusing. And one of the things that I had trouble focusing on reading, I would go back and read books that I had already read. And that was a way to get into reading new material. And I went back and read Station 11, which people said, why are you reading that book? It's about people dying of, you know, like a deadly, the Georgian flu. But it was, you know, like it's ultimately about art and the power of art to save us and community build at a time when, you know, so much of the world has ended as we know it. And so I kind of wanted to write about epidemic in a peripheral way. And the rest of it, you know, like other things worked its way in there, you know, like a shooting, bullying, the retrospect of looking back and thinking, I think, by the narrator, what could I have done differently? What could I have understood differently? That's basically what, it, you know, like, I don't think I make a conscious decision. I just start to write, and I hope that something is going to come out of it. And a lot of times it doesn't, but it's like anything, you know, you practice. You just sit down and you practice. And I'm not a very intuitive writer, that I don't understand where I'm going. I don't have it a clear, you know, I'm fumbling around in the dark trying to find the light switch.
Aren't we all?
Yeah. And if you write long enough, you find the light switch. So the light switch at some point came on in this one. So, yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, it's about the mumps. It's set in a time that is not now. And yet you've got the kid not getting inoculated because of his religious beliefs. So there's so much there that just, it popped out at me. It said, whoa, there are a lot of levels to this.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by, you know, like the Holy Rollers. He had a Holy Roller daddy. The Holy Rollers figure their way into several stories through here. I'm fascinated by that, you know, like when I was growing up in Michigan, there were certain families that were, they didn't permit dancing or gym class or being inoculated. And it was fascinating to me that this separated them out somehow. A lot of times for ridicule, as what happened to this kid. So, you know, I think a lot of writing, even if you're writing fiction, which this is a way to try to understand what you didn't understand before in writing it. So, you know, I kind of created a world and I understand that world. The rest of the world, no, I do not understand.
Do any of us right now?
No. You know, like it's a different world. I'm not ready to, you know, like really jump back feet first. So, yeah.
So as kind of a transition into this, what are you reading right now to help you make sense of things and prepare for a world where we're interacting with each other again?
Well, speaking of jumping in, I'm reading a book called Why We Swim by Bonnie Tsui, T-S-U-I. It's really, it's a lovely kind of hybrid. It's her memoir about growing up swimming in a swimming family. But it's also an investigation about why we swim, why we're attracted to water. I'm an open water swimmer. I as soon as the lake is unfrozen, which was about April 1st, I go in swimming. I was in the other day. Everybody was in a wetsuit. I was like, it's warm. You know, I got in very slowly. And so, yeah, it's a lovely book. It's beautifully written. I just finished a book called Early Morning Riser by Katherine Heine, H-E-I-N-Y, who I became a fan of years ago, I think, when she had a short story in The New Yorker in 1995. And she disappeared for 20 years. And before she finally published that story in a collection of stories. And since then, she's published two novels. And my sister Penelope was reading it for a book club and loaned it to me, and I'm glad she did. It's just a beautiful book that covers, I think, 15, 16, 17 years in a woman's life. Mm. And it's just very quiet, you know, set in Boyne City, Michigan. It's just a really beautiful book. At the very beginning of the pandemic, I read Writers and Lovers by Lily King. I've gone back to that time and time again. It's just another beautiful book about a young woman in her early 30s who wants to be a writer and what she is willing to give up to do that. And it's got a happy ending, which is lovely. And it's a movie development that's going to be directed by Toni Collette, her directorial debut. So I look very much forward to seeing that. So, yeah. So that's basically, you know, like basically what I've been reading. And I went back and read Sue Grafton's Alphabet series from A to Y and marveled again at how that character changed and how Sue Grafton matured as a writer. And I get to Y and I say, oh, she died before she could finish Z. And it's like, oh. So that's basically what I've been doing.
Final question as we get to the end of this half hour, and we've got about a minute left here. What are you going to be working on next, and how has this experience of the last year or so affected and changed that?
Oh, I'm working on putting the final touches on a dystopian novella, and it's got many political overtones in it. There's a character called the Corrupt One, who is the president of the United States, and the supreme leader, who is his former vice president, who, when he took over after 3 million people died in a pandemic, declared himself the supreme leader, and the United States became a theocracy. And it's sort of a cousin to The Handmaid's Tale, but not really. So that's what I've been working on.
Experimenting with a lot of different forms.
It's great fun.
That sounds exciting. I can't wait to read that. Do you think the times won't catch up to it enough to make it?
I don't know. I don't know. But it's just been so much fun. It's just been so much fun writing it. And I'm trying to finish a novel, too.
This has been so much fun talking with you. Sarah Freely, thank you so much for taking time to join us. Her new collection of poems and micro stories is called We. It is available now. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson on Summer Book Week. We continue after a break with Alana Bell. But first, we had the opportunity to catch up with another local author, Sonia Livingston, to ask her what she has been reading this summer.
I'm reading such a great book. It is called Becoming Duchess Goldblatt. And the book is about, well, it's got two main characters. We have the writer, who is anonymous. So if you look for this book, you'll have to know the title because nobody knows the author. So the story is about this anonymous author of the book, but also about the persona that she adopts for her Twitter feed called Duchess Goldblatt.
Who is Duchess Goldblatt?
Duchess Goldblatt is an avatar of this anonymous writer. So she is styled as an 81-year-old inspirational royal, I guess. And on Twitter, her persona is very witty, very light, inspirational, just as she styles herself. So Duchess Goldblatt is not real, except in the Twitterverse, where she is very real. She has about 50,000 followers right now.
Do we know anything at all about who this anonymous author / creator is?
Well, we don't. I don't think that readers will ever know. But some people do know. So the storyline is that the writer is a young woman who's recently gone through a very painful divorce and has some family issues that she's working out. And things are just so tough that she sort of becomes isolated. She doesn't want to interact with people because these relationships have caused her a lot of pain. But like all human beings, she does have a desire to have some kind of social relationships. She decides to adopt this or create this anonymous Duchess Goldblatt. And she says Duchess was born in Klein, Texas. And she says that because Lyle Lovett, the amazing country musician Lyle Lovett, is from Klein, Texas. And this writer is a big fan of his. So she gives Duchess all kinds of a backstory. Duchess has a daughter named Hacienda who is incarcerated. And Duchess is also an author. She's written two memoirs. And the title of her fake memoirs are Feasting on the Carcasses of My Enemies, a Love Story, and An Axe to Grind. So Duchess is this magical, lighthearted creation who has a really interesting backstory developed or created by this anonymous author.
Have you interacted with her on Twitter at all?
I follow her. I'm pretty shy on Twitter. I think one thing that I like about this book is that Duchess Goldblatt is really funny and smart and nice to the people who follow her. She's really created a community because she is pretty loving in her own way. But I tend to be somebody who holds back a little bit on Twitter. So I really enjoy her tweets, but I don't interact with her except to like them.
What else are you working on right now? What's in the pipeline? What are your projects right now?
I'm working on two projects right now. Thank you for asking. One is about I tend to write a lot about class and poverty, and specifically white male poverty, or actually male poverty, regardless of race. So I'm working on these serious essays about class in America. But I've also started writing about some ancestors. I recently did some DNA testing, like lots of people, and I've uncovered all kinds of really interesting people, and I'm researching and writing about those people.
Neat. How has the pandemic affected you? Were you able to keep reading and being creative during?
Yeah, it depends what time of the pandemic. At first, it felt like La La Land. Like I felt a little bit like a cloistered religious person in a very good way, and that I was able to get lots of writing done, to take walks, to eat good food, all of those things. And then reality came crashing through the pandemic. So I kept teaching, albeit online, and that certainly, had the same challenges as always. So the pandemic has been both good and challenging, I think, like for a lot of people.
And you've been here in Rochester more through it.
I've been here a lot more through it. That's a real treat of the pandemic. I wonder how many people would say it that way, but it feels that way for me right now, especially because in Richmond, Virginia, where I also live the half year, it's really hot. And today it's like 75 in Rochester and perfect.
It's Rochester author Sonia Livingston telling me what she's reading this summer. I'm Scott Feibusch. We have more Connections Summer Book Week coming up. We'll hear from Brooklyn poet and audio artist Alana Bell. She's coming up right after this break as Connections Summer Book Week continues. Stay with us, won't you? Welcome back to Summer Book Week on Connections and a pre-recorded hour devoted to poets and poetry. Alana Bell's new book, Mother Country, is a recent release from Rochester's BOA Editions. She's a poet, a sound practitioner, and, as she describes it, a creative alchemist. Her debut collection a decade ago won the Walt Whitman Award from the Society of American Poets. She sings with the Resistance Revival Chorus, and she's been on stage with Patti Smith and Sweet Honey and the Rock, among others. We're definitely going to talk about that at some point in this half hour. And she joins us now from Brooklyn. Alana, welcome to Connections.
Thank you so much for having me.
So glad you could join us. I want to start off with your book, Mother Country. I do want to warn listeners, there are some intense themes in here, especially involving miscarriages. If this is something that may be triggering to you, you may want to hold off, listen to the podcast later, or join us back for Book Week later on. But it's a book that really, at least to my reading of it, intertwines two stories. In the first half of it, it's your mother's struggles with Parkinson's disease near the end of her life and your struggle to bring a new life into the world and have a baby. And then in the second half, we kind of move forward and you're a new mother now, confronting some of the realities of what it's actually like to have brought a baby into the world and have it as a physical reality that you're dealing with. Was this always intended as being a single volume? Did you start off picturing it that way?
So, you know, I think the funny thing about putting a poetry book together is it's not always, it doesn't always have a linear trajectory. I think that, you know, some of these poems, one about bringing my mother, for example, to the electroconvulsive therapy ward, that poem was begun more than 15 years ago, you know, before I even had written anything that was in my previous book. So it really was a journey. And I think at a certain point it clicked in me that when I started to work to become a mother, which didn't come easily to me, you know, the book speaks not only about miscarriages, but about assisted reproductive technology. There was a real awareness of, oh, I'm trying to become a mother and I'm also a daughter. And there's this like, there's a through line here. And that through line is made up of a lot of different things, including, you know, some ancestral trauma, my mother's struggles with Parkinson's and mental illness and how that played out. So, you know, I don't think I knew going in all that the themes would cover, but once the book started to have its own sort of personality and show me what it was, you know, most of the poems I was drawing from those different periods, and it sort of came together in that way, if that makes sense.
It does. So the writing process on this obviously was a long one. The time frame in which this is all actually taking place, was this simultaneous with your mother's struggles and with trying to have a baby? This was all actually going on at the same time?
So my mother's struggles began quite some time before I wanted to have a baby. They began when I was 21. She had her second major depressive episode triggered by a hormonal shift by being premenopausal. And it was quite significant. And she went through electroconvulsive therapy, more commonly known as shock therapy. And then that helped her. And then she had a relapse. And then shortly after was diagnosed with Parkinson's, actually when my husband and I had just started dating. It was about the first 6 months of our relationship. And so that sort of well of grief and that kind of journey with my mother's illness, and my mother and I were very close. My mother also is a poet, although, not necessarily for a career, but she has published books, published poems in anthologies and collections. And so that was also another interesting thing, was like, oh, discovering that I didn't even think about that, but like my mother, that also being part of the lineage that's passed on. But so that was a much longer journey. And then later on came the journey to become a mother myself, which is more recent, you know, but still, I mean, that was over a My son is five, but we had a good like 3 year period where we were trying 3 to 5 year period trying to become parents.
And there is this occurred to me on Father's Day, and you know, just over this past weekend, that you know I'm at this phase in my life where right now I am both a father and I have a father, and I'm acutely conscious that's not going to be forever, that it's a brief thing. And so you've captured at this moment in time where you're in the process of going from one to the other. I want to talk a little bit about some of the ways in which you write your poems. There are a lot of styles of poetry in here. There are some pieces that you know really play as short prose pieces, and there are pieces that are much more structured, clearly, as poems. Where, if at all, do you draw that distinction?
You know, I believe that the poem tells you what it wants to be. Like, I don't often go in saying, I'm going to write this kind of a poem, or I'm going to do, I think certain, with the more lyric sort of poems that you might identify more clearly as, you know, traditional lyric poems, sometimes there'll be a line or an image that kind of leads the way, and it's following that impulse. With, for example, the final poem in the book, Afterbirth, which is a very long prose poem written in short sections, that poem was actually birthed in the very early, or at least the beginnings of it were birthed in the first 6 months of my son's life, when I was the primary caretaker, when I had him strapped to my chest and I was in my iPhone, you know, I who had only written longhand was like with my iPhone typing notes in the notes section. And I called it, at that time, it was called the mommy journal in my, you know, in my phone. And then I just kept working with that. And so that, it was the organic form that poem took. Now, of course, eventually I printed it out, I edited, I put it to, you know, I expanded on it, and certain things were written after that brief period. But the sort of seed of it and the crux of it was written in that way and couldn't have been written any other way. It had to be, and you'll see it's very collaged, and kind of juxtapositions are a lot of what give it, I think, its power. And so, you know, each poem really has a different journey, I think.
But it's the reality too, and I say this as somebody who was a parent of young children now quite a few years ago and is now sending them off into the world, which is its whole other kind of weird experience and a whole other different chapter. But it was very evocative for me, having been working at home through a lot of this with when my children were little, of exactly where that mindset is of you can't do everything that you want to do. And there was a line, we just a couple of days ago had your publisher, Peter Connors, in here on the show for our panel discussion with publishers. And I'm not going to take any credit for this line because it's a line that he gave me. But he said that your poems talk about things that mothers don't talk about in public necessarily. And that's very true. You are extremely, extremely graphic, extremely visceral about things like changing the baby's diapers and about some of these physical realities. Was that a difficult decision to be that open in print?
I mean, I don't know how to write any other way. Like I'm pretty, I think I learned from my teachers that, you know, and when I say teachers, both actual poets that I study with and also teachers, when I say I just reading their work, I mean, Sharon Olds is a great example to me of someone who really gives details of the body and the body's processes and creates poetry from that, you know. And I think that also in a way is a feminist act, specifically for women to write about their bodies and what happens to their bodies and their experiences and share that in a public way and say, this is worthy material of, this is poetic material. This is worthy of being, you know, in a book of poetry, because these are, as much as concentrating on a beautiful flower or a pond or, you know, the Greeks. And I don't say that dismissively. I think that poetry holds room for all of it, but this is a part for me, you know, of my poetic lineage, of the poets that I look to as truth tellers. And another piece of it for me, and this comes into play even more for me, actually, there's only one poem that's explicit about my own struggles with depression, but, you know, naming these things and having them taken out of a space of shame, I think is actually a way that poetry can reach beyond even its literary value, and I think be of value. You know, I hope that this book is of value to mothers so that they don't feel so alone in these aspects that aren't shared publicly often. And I think, by the way, that that's changing. I mean, you know, I'm sure Peter mentioned Kendra DiColo's book, which is, you know, just come out, and other, I think motherhood is one subject that is certainly, as sex had, you know, maybe 20 years ago, started to be something that was spoken about in a different kind of way where people could really, and to find the poetry in that. And I find poetry, the best poetry on whatever subject matter, I think, is something that takes these moments of struggle, pain, and alchemizes them into something that I would call of beauty, but I don't mean beauty in like sort of a like a rose kind of way, but I mean beauty in the naming of them, in the claiming of them, in the giving of them specificity and haunting images.
And identifying the things that we feel and don't know what we're feeling.
Absolutely.
And how to describe it. We are talking with Alanna Bell. Her book is Mother Country, newly out, recently out from Rochester's BOA Editions, here on Summer Book Week on Connections. Before we get too much further, I want to point out that you spent some time here in Rochester during the pandemic. Explain how that came about and what you got from your time here in Greater Rochester.
Well, we had been living in Brooklyn, and as soon as they closed the schools, we have a, at the time, 4-year-old, now 5-year-old, in a small 2-bedroom apartment. Both my husband and I were working remotely teaching, and he also works for Spotify, and I was seeing clients, and it was just, we couldn't imagine how we were going to do that with a small child. And so luckily my husband's sister, who taught at RIT, opened her home to us, and we spent 4 months there and really benefited from the beauty of Rochester, the natural beauty. We got to go to Highland Park and to some of the surrounding national parks. Unfortunately, we didn't get to really hang out with a lot of people from Rochester and get in. I mean, I know a former colleague and friend, Rachel McKibbins, has a wonderful series that happens up there. And so we didn't get to do any of the fabulous live cultural events, but it was a really helpful time to have this place, and much quieter and less kind of condensed and contracted than living in Brooklyn.
They're coming back, though. Everything's reopening. You'll have to come back up now that that's all happening. And Rachel and Jacob are fantastic. That would definitely be great to get you up here for that. You were talking about bringing out some of these feelings through poetry, and I want to talk about some of the other things that you do as a sound practitioner. Explain to me a little bit about what this is and how it interacts with your poetic creativity.
Sure. I work with different, I use voice, and I use a series of mostly drone and atonal instruments from different cultures. I have a Shruti box from North India. I have a manalina, which is a German instrument based on the monochord, a gong, which is from China. So all these different instruments, and really use them to support people in connecting to their calming the nervous system, kind of quieting what I call the front office mind, the sort of busy to-do mind, and really dropping more deeply into the nervous system, taking it out of fight or flight. So it's something that I began working with actually in my early months of becoming a mother, because I was experiencing some postpartum anxiety. And I had taken a class with a teacher named Sylvia Nakach. And I started with a very simple humming practice. Humming for 21 minutes a day. It might sound very simple. I highly recommend it for actually getting the brain into focus, quieting thoughts. I have trouble with more traditional sitting meditations because my mind is going. So having the sound has been really helpful. And now that has, from that place, I really started, I worked with a music therapist and started, then went to a training and really deepened my relationship to sound and sound as a creative modality. And I now offer individual and group sound journeys. And I also use it, I teach creativity workshops privately, not institutionally. And I use these different practices with my, with the participants in these workshops. And I find that it really supports them in accessing their creative channel in a different way than if it's just like, sit down and write, let me give you a prompt. But we're actually tapping into the body in a different way. And I found it's been very, very helpful for people to tap into their authentic voice. And I would say that's what I mean by being a creative alchemist, is really using whatever's coming through you and alchemizing it into some form of expression, whether it's published or seen or not. I think it's a very important part of being a human being.
Or sung, you're a singer as well. And you've worked at Juilliard. How does that interact with the rest
of
us?
Juilliard, I actually teach poetry to actors, which is super fun. They're incredibly open and fabulous. And then I also have the privilege of singing. As I said, I sing in these sound journeys that I offer, and I also sing with a group called the Resistance Revival Chorus. And we were began in the Women's March in 2017. And it's a collective of 60 women and non-binary artists and activists who use song as a form of, at the time, resisting the political regime that we were a part of, for those of us that didn't find that to be sort of how we felt our country should be run and the sort of backward steps that we saw it going in. And so this gathering of, and so we sang at a lot of protests as well as different events and fundraisers, and have also had the privilege of being on stage with some incredible luminaries, including Ani DeFranco, Patti Smith, Carly Simon, and singing at benefits. So it's been a real joy to be a part of that ensemble.
It's exciting. There is, if not a political, at least a historical subtext to a couple of the poems in here. You are the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. There's one poem set in the 2003 blackout, which is vividly memorable to me because my wife was 8 months pregnant right in the midst of this during a heat wave here in Rochester. And your grandmother refers to it being as dark as Hitler. Mm-hmm. In the city during that, where did that line come from? How does that?
So in that poem, my grandmother's the Holocaust survivor, but my mother was the firstborn after that. And I think a lot of the ancestral trauma that she experienced being the firstborn of a Holocaust survivor really contributed to some of her mental illness. And so in that poem in particular, it was actually based on a conversation that we had where I called her, I can't remember, during the blackout, and she said, and this is, you know, a symptom of sort of having voices, like a psychotic episode. And she said, oh, I think maybe my evil thoughts caused the blackout. Maybe that's, you know, it's that kind of thing. And so, and it was the poetic license was me saying, you know, that she said, she didn't literally say my thoughts are black as Hitler. That was my poetic imagery that I took and created. What I just, using Kimiko Han's words, like truth with a capital T, like artistic truth being different than fact. You know, when you put the poem together, you sometimes take things that didn't literally happen. So the conversation literally happened, but that image was one that I created from the way she was speaking about this darkness that lived inside of her and that she believed was so powerful it could create a blackout, a darkness citywide in a city that she was 3,000 miles away from.
So she was on the West Coast during all this. Wow. You are very careful in your acknowledgments, even when it's just fragmentary thoughts that have gone into a poem, to credit the original poet. That obviously is important to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's, as artists, that I would want that done for me. And I think it's a very, it's kind of this sort of like capitalist American idea that we're all sort of self-made. I think we all come from a lineage, you know, and that lineage, you know, in many cultures, you honor your teachers always, no matter how long you've studied with them. And so I absolutely am the product of both my own ancestral, you know, biological lineage, as I've mentioned, my mother's a poet, and also of my teachers and teachers that I've never met but have met through their reading. I mean, I consider Lucille Clifton a teacher of mine, another BOA poet, Naomi Shihab Nye, who I have met, and she is lovely, but I never studied with them per se, but I see them as part of my poetic lineage that I benefited from coming after.
Your publisher at BOA, Peter Connors, mentioned when we had him on the show as part of our publisher panel that they're branching out now into audiobooks. Do you want your poems to be heard out loud as well as read? How do you want readers to encounter them? And is there a possibility of you doing something sound related with some of this work?
I love that question. So I believe that I love to, I love reading and performing poetry. Although I never was really a slammer, I was part of a slam community in Manhattan for many years. And many of those poets have gone on to become, including Rachel, like, you know, succeeded in a very literary context. But so I love poems being read and performed and imbued with emotion and passion and energy. So I would love to do an audiobook if that comes to be. And I've also had the opportunity to collaborate with my sound partner, that I work with, where we took a recording of one of my poems and he added the soundscape and video. So I love collaboration. I also worked with a composer Elise Tessier, and she took some of the poems and created original compositions. And some of it, she used my recordings of my voice, and she added different instrumental and vocal compositions. So I'm a big fan of collaboration, artistic collaboration, and certainly of encountering poems in more than one form, not just on the page.
Peter Connors, if you're listening, I think we have a project for you. What are you working on next? What's next?
Well, I've been really focusing on my sound work. I really want to record an album. I've written some original compositions as well as chants, and then also these vocal improvisations that are part of the soundscape. So that's really sort of the next artistic project. And then I also have a new manuscript that I'm working on, which I kind of am not ready to talk too much about. I will say thematically, it's looking at the domestication of female desire. But it's very much in the early stages.
Fascinating. We'll look forward, hopefully, to having you on again at some point, and maybe even back here in Rochester. Alana Bell, thank you so much for taking some time to join us on Connections.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure to be here. I love the questions, and I look forward to hearing all of the different interviews. Sounds like you have a great lineup.
Thanks so much. They are all available on our podcast and on the Book Week page at WXXINews.org. Alana Bell is the author of Mother Country, a book of poems from Rochester's BOA Editions. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson this week on Book Week. Our executive producer is Megan Mack. Emma Ray Stein is our producer. Rob Braden is at the controls. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got more Book Week yet ahead. Stay with us all week on Connections.